this week's 51%, we hear from a professor whose organization strives to empower women and girls in Africa.
What about those girls who are in rural areas? Who supports them? Who are the role models?
A teen shares a story about her experience in Kenya, and a nurse during the Vietnam War finds a way to cope and help others. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Dr. Hawa Hamza is a professor at Niagara University in upstate New York. Her Global Network for Niger, or GNN, is more than a year old and continues its goal of assisting women and children in Africa with health and education concerns, despite attacks by Boko Haram in her own hometown of Diffa, a small city in southeastern Niger, West Africa. Dr. Hamza talks about GNN's mission.
And its mission is to empower women and children of Niger to build a sustainable future in an arid sub-Saharan environment we call Sahel in French. I'm very fortunate to have my parents' unconditional support for my education in spite of cultural pressures. But really, looking back at all my years of studying in Niger, in England, and right here at Kent State University in Ohio, and as important as scholarship is to my professional life, I know I needed to find an alternative way to directly impact other girls and women and enhance their life chances. So I thought of creating an NGO.
What is the biggest need among women and children in Niger?
This is very interesting because I think a very important reason, and I will come to the needs aspect, is my heightened awareness of the issue of child marriage leading to the reality of early brides and its consequences on women's lives, leading to many women experiencing poor health, illiteracy, and poverty, thus reducing their life chances. And two of these factors, education and health, are commonly known as factors of development in any nation. So I thought these are where my efforts would really be invested in terms of helping children with their health issues, girls with their schooling, women with the issue of high illiteracy rate in Niger, which is very unfortunate.
The NGO came into being in February 2015. So what has happened since?
Even though we cannot give a whole list of accomplishments, I think for the short amount of time that we've existed, several things have happened. In Niger, for example, we have been able to create what we will call GNN Africa. So we created an office there with board members. We have received a donation of a land from the mayor of Diffa. Hopefully, that's where we really want to develop some infrastructures in terms of supporting women and girls. In 2013, I was able to travel back and donate some medicine to the local dispensary, which really served me as a child. I donated some school supplies as well to the elementary school I attended. This past fall, we did actually finally create GNN Europe. So we have board members over there too. And so at this point, we are on three continents. One of the things that we intend to do or anticipate to do is do some fundraising And there are so many organizations, agencies, multilaterally that could help, and some sources of funding that we would need to connect with to help us accomplish our mission.
10 days prior to GNN's formal incorporation, the Islamic extremist group Boko Haram attacked your hometown. Your family and friends scattered. Some fled to the capital city about 1,000 miles west. So when the headlines on an issue or incident fade, how do you keep others focused on an issue when you're competing worldwide with so many causes?
This is really a great question. And we know, we always hear the common phrase, competition for scarce resources, right? And we are very much aware of it. And as a very young organization, one of our challenges right now, after achieving that not-for-profit profit status, is actually to now expand our membership. And since we call ourselves the Global Network for Niger, we really anticipate doing that not just locally, but also globally, right? We have a website, which is theglobalnetworkniger.net, where we are also inviting to visit members to visit, or simply asking people to visit and see what our mission is, what our goals are. Now, we are very much aware issues are raised and there is such a focus on it, and then it goes away. But my vision of creating this organization predated Boko Haram. I am very committed to this cause because, as I mentioned at the beginning, my parents really worked hard to get me where I am today, knowing all the cultural pressures that say a young girl should be married by the age of 13, 14. And I did not fit that kind of expectation, and I did not do that. And my sisters after me did not actually go through that kind of experience. So to me, I have parents and uncles and aunts. I have role models, and I have people who supported me to be where I am today. But what about those girls who are in rural areas? Who supports them? Who are the role models? And therefore, to me, this is something that I need to look back and give back to the community. And this kind of passion will not die.
I'm so glad you brought up role models, because I think they play such an important role throughout a person's life. And that's not gender specific. I think the greatest gifts you can give a girl, especially one who is disadvantaged, are empowerment and education, not strictly in the classroom, but in life in general. And I imagine going forward, you will be highly focused on this.
Yes, indeed, because actually Boko Haram is a blessing in disguise for all the bad things they did. As far as our goal here and our mission of focusing on girls' education, since their slogan is Boko Haram, which simply means that Western education is illegal, it helped illustrate really the mission. It fits the mission and the goals of GNN. And I think that is the reason why I created the counter-narrative that says Boko Halal instead of Haram. Halal means legal. And I think we must support a powerful alternative to illiteracy, a cycle of poverty, and violent victimization of girls by educating their minds and resisting the helplessness of watching a 10-year-old girl's body destroyed by a bomb forcefully strapped to her chest. And that did happen in my own community. I never saw that. That makes me think that I was very lucky when all I had to do is simply leave my hometown and go with my uncle and continue my studies. How about those girls who do not have family members who are educated or role models. So that's really where my inspiration comes from, which is why I will continue this work.
Is there anything else you wanted to discuss?
Yes. One thing that I would like to really emphasize is the fact that Niger is a sub-Saharan African nation. It is a place that is arid, desertic. So what I'm also hoping to do through the NGO is see GNN taking a leading role in advocating for inquiries into NGOs' sustainable development practices in Africa. Because I know the community and I know the realities in terms of climate and in terms of culture, I would be really encouraging strategies and activities and programs that really do have the population's interests in mind. And that is something that I really anticipating working for real hard within this NGO.
That was Dr. Hawa Hamza talking about GNN, or Global Network for Niger, her NGO, whose mission is to empower girls and women of Niger for a sustainable future. The website is globalnetworkniger.net. We now turn elsewhere in Africa, but stick to a theme of education. As many students have planned or are planning what to do this summer, high school student Evan Burke talks about a life-changing experience last summer on the tea plantations of Kenya. She decided to aid the workers by creating a nonprofit organization.
What did you do this past summer? Go on vacation? Hang out with your friends? For 17-year-old Evan Burke, her summer was much different.
This past summer, my sister and I, we traveled to Kenya, and we went to this small rural village in like the highlands of Kenya. And there, all of these women like work on these giant like tea plantations, because like that's just a really quick way for them to like make money, because it's really hard for them to find like actual jobs like in the workplace.
Evan did not travel to Kenya, Africa to observe the lives of these women. Evan lived the lives of these women.
We actually slept in the houses of the girls who worked on the plantations with us when we were there. And we were there for about a week. And I mean, they live in shanties. Like, they're these little tin shacks and like they're cooking on the floor. And I mean, it's just pretty shocking to see. So we would be getting up at like 6 a.m. when the sun was rising, and we would eat, and not to sound weird, but it was this really disgusting like slop, like porridge. But the point of it is to just sit in your stomach, because you don't get to eat until like 7 at night. You've got this huge basket on your back and you're just picking these leaves like over and over and over for like 12 hours and just throwing them over. And then after you're done, you have to walk with your huge basket of leaves over to this tea collection center, and there you have to wait for like this truck to come. And it's just a super long day. Some of these women are picking up to 50 kilograms of tea leaves a day. And so that's like a huge amount of weight to carry.
Despite the brutal hours and hours of work the women on the plantations endured, their demeanor was one of contentment.
Everyone was so gracious and so like happy, like, because this is like really difficult labor that they're working. And like, it's hot outside. You're not eating, you're not drinking. And, like, all of the girls that we were talking to, I mean, they're just so happy.
Evan and her younger sister went to Kenya with the intentions of wanting to help the women workers there, yet they did not know exactly how to do that. After communicating with the younger generation of workers, whose ages ranged from 12 to 21, Evan realized an education was what these women needed most to improve their futures.
What we're really trying to do is we're hoping that by trying to provide an education for girls like the ones we worked with, that we'll be able to create like a future generation of girls with a hope for their education, with a hope for their future in the workplace.
Evan and her sister created a nonprofit organization where 100% of proceeds go back to the girls they met in Kenya.
So the name of my organization is Kupatia, which happens to sound a little bit like cup of tea, and that means to give in Swahili. And so we just thought that was really cute, and it's like a total like message of what we're trying to do. we decided that we wanted to sell tea just as kind of like a like full circle way to connect it back to them. And so that's how we came up with Cupatia. And basically we sell bags of tea and we have our whole message and stuff imprinted on the bag. As of now, we're just trying to sell Cupatia in more of a Girl Scout cookie method. So we've been doing it by word of mouth and we've been speaking at different meetings and organizations, which has been really exciting. And we're also selling our tea online at cupatia.org.
Without the help of Evan's mentor and inspiration, none of this could have happened.
What inspired my sister and I to travel to Kenya is that this woman, Roslyn, she's my dad's business partner, and she's known my sister and I since we were practically born. And she actually happens to come from Kenya, and she was born there. And so she made her way as like a successful businesswoman in America. And I mean, that's really the dream for girls from Africa, just because you want to break out of this cycle of poverty, and she was able to do so. Cupatia is kind of a way of like giving back to her. That's kind of what it was inspired by. But it's grown into like so much more. Like after seeing these girls and meeting them and like hearing their story, I just really love the idea of being able to help other girls, especially ones my age who just aren't like lucky enough to live the kind of life that we do.
Thank you for listening. For more stories like this, visit openorchardproductions.org. If you would like to contribute to Evan's Foundation or would like to learn more about it, visit cupatia.com, cupatia.com.
And we hear from another teen who did not have to go far to gain a different perspective. Youth Radio's Natalie Battendorf discovers how taking a wrong turn can lead to the right path.
One day after school, I found myself walking up a nearby hiking trail. But I really found myself when I got to the top. I'm Natalie Bettendorf with a commentary from Youth Radio. Before long, both my dog and I were panting at the hill's steepness. The overhanging pines felt suffocating, and dust clouded the thick, hot air. I was so focused on my surroundings that I barely noticed what was just beyond the trees, an incredible 180-degree view of the whole Bay Area. Seeing the little world where I live from afar once I reached the top was comforting and calming. Every person down there was also dealing with their own problems. So even though I was hiking by myself, I didn't feel so alone. Seeing each house, each car, each street panned out before me made my problems feel smaller too. As an anxious person, I tend to overanalyze and stress over small situations. That day, I found a much-needed escape from my nervous energy. I guess all it takes to shift your perspective is a step back and a few steps uphill. For Youth Radio, I'm Natalie Bettendorf.
Diane Carlson Evans was a U.S. Army nurse during the Vietnam War. She survived indescribable trauma, felt resented when she returned to the U.S., and kept her bitterness and her tears inside for many years. Then she founded the Vietnam Women's Memorial Project and helped hundreds of women veterans tell their stories of Vietnam.
You're listening to Mountain West Voices. I'm Clay Scott. When Diane Carlson Evans went to Vietnam in 1968, she was 21 years old, a Minnesota farm kid, and unprepared for life as an Army nurse in a war zone. She got used to it in a hurry.
I didn't do drugs in Vietnam, thankfully. But I had my own drug, and it was adrenaline. And man, I loved my adrenaline. In Vietnam, I was going from one bed to the next. The next. And I was hanging IVs and I was sucking out trachs and I was taking care of chest tubes and I was constant motion, constant moving. And our hospital had been overrun many times and we had taken rockets and mortars to our hospital and we were so resigned to just not going home.
Diane's time in Vietnam was intense and it was intensely meaningful for her. She survived on camaraderie and on the sense that she was doing work that mattered. Her return to the U.S. was a disaster.
Nobody wanted to listen to what we had seen, what we had been through, what we had done. That's the men and the women. It wasn't a popular war, and we weren't popular.
Diane got a job at a hospital in Minneapolis, but she only lasted a few weeks before she quit. She re-upped with the Army Nurse Corps and found herself in Texas, where she spent 6 years working in intensive care at a military hospital. She met her husband there, and she started a family, and the work was challenging, but she says she still dealt with feelings of bitterness and with a profound sense of isolation.
I used to actually wonder if I'd ever been to Vietnam. I used to wonder if I made it up. Now I know words for this because I've been through counseling, and words like disassociative, you disassociate, or you compartmentalize. And I've learned that it's also called post-traumatic stress disorder.
A turning point for Diane came in 1980 when she heard about the dedication of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C.
I remember telling my husband, I'm going, and I'm going alone. I told him, I went to Vietnam alone, I came home alone, and I have to do this alone.
When Diane got to the memorial, she looked at the wall with its 50,000 names of Vietnam War dead arranged in chronological order. Among all the hundreds of patients she had cared for, she could only think of one name, Eddie Lee Evanson from Thief River Falls, Minnesota.
When I found Eddie's name, I touched his name, and for the first time since Vietnam, I cried. Mike used to say to me, my husband, you know, you're the strangest woman. You never cry. I didn't even cry at my brother's funeral. He was 38 years old and died of cancer and was a farmer and had six wonderful little kids. And I went to his funeral and I never cried. I didn't have any tears. And I stood there and I just started to cry and I couldn't stop. And it was like I had found Eddie again.
It wasn't long after her return from that trip that Diane founded the Vietnam Women's Memorial Project, a mammoth undertaking that took 7 years of testimony and two congressional bills and culminated in the Vietnam Women's Memorial in Washington, D.C.
That was very profound for me because I was an intensive care nurse. I liked doing that stuff. I liked intensity and I liked hanging that blood. I liked that challenge, but I realize now I'm healing the psychological wounds, and they're just as necessary as giving a pint of blood, because it saves people's lives to save their mental health. And I've become very good at it, in that I believe in the healing power of memorials and what they can do for us. And I believe in the healing power of stories, because for me, it was always about the stories.
You've been listening to Diane Carlson Evans, founder of the Vietnam Women's Memorial in Washington, D.C. Mountain West Voices is produced in association with the O'Connor Center for the Rocky Mountain West, a regional studies and public education program of the University of Montana. Additional support was provided by the Greater Montana Foundation. For more stories from around the Rocky Mountain West, go to mountainwestnews.org. I'm Clay Scott.
This summer, a municipal pool that maintains female-only hours so that Hasidic Jewish women can swim with no men present has raised alarms in New York City. Critics say the accommodation to a particular religious group violates the constitutional separation of church and state. But defenders say the women-only swim sessions at the Metropolitan Recreation Center give women whose community separates the sexes a rare chance to exercise. The pool hours sparked controversy after the city's Commission on Human Rights received an anonymous tip that the pool might be violating the city's human rights law. The City Parks Department says it is reviewing its policy, but the women-only sessions, which occur four times per week, will remain in effect for now. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at WAMC.org and follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1404.